Hello everyone, this is John MacArthur. I'm here in the Wikibon offices. Today is Tuesday, January 22nd, and I'm here with the founder of Wikibon, Dave Vellante.
Good afternoon, John. How are you doing? Hi, everybody.
Good to see you. We are live streaming today on SiliconANGLE TV. Just a quick reminder to everyone, or instructions to everyone, please press star 6 to mute your line now. I'll wait for a second for everyone to do so, but press star 6 to mute your line. And then when if you have questions later during the call, you can press star 6 to unmute so that you can ask questions of our guests or anyone in the any of the analysts today. So the title of today's Peer Insight is Commercial Applications and Hyperscale Storage. We've covered the topic of hyperscale storage a few times here on Wikibon. We've had guests from Shutterfly, and we've had the CTO from CleverSafe. Today we're joined by Vice President Russ Kennedy. Russ, can you hear us?
Yes. Hi, John.
Thanks for joining us today. Russ, as we kick this off, I'd like you to talk, because we've talked about sort of government applications where hyperscale storage matters, and we've talked about, some of the new applications like Shutterfly. We've talked to them about their use of hyperscale storage. I want you to give us an update on what you see, what's going on, maybe first of all with the kinds of accounts that are dealing with these issues, and then a little bit about where you see it happening in the future.
Sure. So first of all, thanks for the opportunity to join you today. I think this is a very interesting topic. Where we see sort of the trends in the market and things driving the need for hyperscale, I think a lot of it's around consumers and consumer devices. As today, everybody has, or a lot of people have, smart devices on their person. They can take a lot of pictures, take video, et cetera, capture information. And then, services like Facebook and Shutterfly and others, they're around to help people share those images and those pictures and that audio content with their friends and other folks. So those organizations are well understanding sort of the hyperscale kind of problem, because they're dealing with that amount of data and they're dealing with that, that sort of use case. The general population developing their own content, wanting to distribute or share that content with others. So that's sort of driving that world. As you mentioned in your intro, there's a number of organizations, particularly in governments, that are capturing a lot of that, that kind of data as well. Video surveillance, satellite imagery, scientific information, weather information, those kinds of things are being captured, and that's sort of driving hyperscale storage in those organizations. But I think the really interesting question that comes to mind is how is the rest of the world sort of going to deal with this as it comes online? And I think, again, some of the drivers of that are going to be individuals and humans wanting to, in an enterprise or in a standard working environment, share information, not necessarily in email form or text form, but share it in video form or share it in audio form. And a lot of that's going to drive, I think, sort of the proliferation of storage, just like it's doing in the consumer space today, in the enterprise world. And is point where they want to offer services to their employees to collaborate and share information, and particularly to share information in video format or image format. I think it's just going to drive hyperscale storage in those arenas.
Thanks, Ross. Just a reminder to anyone who's not speaking, please press star 6 now to mute your line if you haven't already muted it. So within commercial applications, commercial businesses, when you talk about video content, is that maybe the one of the best examples, or is it other kinds of content also that's driving the massive capacity growth?
Well, I think anything that where employees are going to collaborate on, a work project or or things that they're building, or a new product, or a new service. You know, those kinds of things are going to drive a lot of interaction. They're going to drive a lot of creation, content creation, you know, design creation, et cetera, et cetera. And that's obviously going to generate a lot of digital information. And you know, these organizations are now looking for ways to get, you know, people around the globe, perhaps, to collaborate or work together on, you know, the same piece of data or the same piece of information. So, you know, as you grow and you scale and you look at, you know, the size and the complexity of these environments, you got to consider the fact that, you know, data is going to be created in a lot of different formats, and it's going to want to be distributed, shared, updated, used, et cetera, by a number of different entities within an organization. I mean, I think that's what's driving a lot of the private cloud initiatives today are, you know, the fact that organizations want to not only lower costs but add more services to their internal employees to say, you know, you can now work with, you know, let's say people around the world on a particular project and collaborate and share information in a cloud that we're managing and we're maintaining for you. It you know, it certainly gives security, it certainly gives advantages around, you know, privacy and security versus a public cloud offering like a, you know, like an Amazon or something along those lines. But I think more and more large enterprises and even emerging enterprises are going to start to take advantage of technology and offer more services internally to their employees to do more online collaboration.
Dave just got back from a conference on the West Coast, where there was a lot of discussion regarding hyperscale storage or hyperscale storage requirements.
Yeah, actually, I wasn't there. I was watching the live stream, but David Floyer was there. I think David Floyer's in the call. John Furrier was there. And it struck me as quite interesting in terms of the differences between hyperscale and traditional enterprises. Maybe it's worth talking about that a little bit, but let me just, you know, talk about some of the things that I learned just from watching the stream. For those of you who don't know, the Open Compute Platform Summit, OCP Summit, is really sponsored by Facebook. It's actually Facebook's reference architecture for how they build out infrastructure. And, you know, Facebook spends $1 billion a year on capital equipment for its infrastructure, which is a nice budget. And essentially, if you look at the hyperscale market, these are some of the things that I came up with there. They tend to be very early adopters. They deploy what I would say either are purpose-built servers, or maybe they're even custom servers that are built by ODMs that are specific to hyperscale, and similar approaches to storage. Obviously, there's scale-out. There's a lot of read-only going on, or read-heavy going on. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of cheap and deep. I mean, it's cheap SATA, even less expensive SATA, even less expensive SSD, whereas if you contrast that with the enterprise, it's kind of the fat middle to late majority. You know, they let the OEMs do the qualifying for them. It's IBM and EMC and NetApp and Dell that are doing the qualification. And they're using commercial off-the-shelf components from the likes of those companies or HP or Dell or maybe even sometimes OEMs. A much write-heavier environment, and they're using the higher-end blend of whether it's, you know, spinning disk or SSD. And I guess the big difference that I see, I wonder if people should comment on this, is that it's really the hyperscale guys are software-led. I mean, they're really putting software function, layering software as services on top of that commodity infrastructure, whereas today in the enterprise, there's a lot of function embedded into arrays, for example. And that sort of was my takeaways from the OCP Summit. I wonder if anybody else has any thoughts or comments there, or Russ.
Yeah, so I think, you know, you certainly laid it out very well, you know, in terms of what companies like Facebook are looking to do. I mean, they obviously have huge challenges from an infrastructure perspective, and they have huge challenges from a growth perspective, and they're looking for solutions that can, you know, can deliver value and can deliver capability, you know, at a cost point that makes sense for their business, at a cost point that makes sense for, you know, their need to scale out and scale up and to grow and be able to, you know, manage the data and the infrastructure that they have to manage to deliver the services to their customers. So they're certainly well aware of those challenges, and they definitely are looking at, you know, things like open compute and other commodity-oriented technology to kind of help drive some of that. And there are other companies that are certainly at that or at similar scales and need to grow at similar rates. So I think that's very appropriate. As you said, most of the enterprises, however, are a little bit behind that in terms of what they're looking at or what they may be buying these days. They may be going more for a traditional approach or a traditional vendor approach versus something that's open or promoted as an open platform. That being said, I think they're going to eventually run into the same challenges as we were talking about. As more and more content is being generated in an enterprise and being generated to be shared or to be used in a collaborative manner across an enterprise, I think they're going to run into similar types of challenges that the big guys, the big Web 2.0 or social media companies have already started to tackle, and they're going to be looking for similar types of solutions that are they're easily scaled out. They allow them to add software and services and capabilities on top of a core hardware platform that they can build out and deliver on a very rapid and easy to deploy scale and be able to handle the challenges and growth challenges that are coming down the road. So I think you're absolutely right. It's going to be a little bit of time before the traditional enterprises are at that point, but I think they're going that way.
Okay, so your premise is that these guys, the scale-out guys, are a harbinger to what's coming in the future, and you said it's a little bit of time. How much time?
Yeah,
5 to 10 years away from that, or is it sooner?
I think it's probably a couple of years away, but not much more than a couple of years away. I mean, if you just look at what's projected in terms of growth rate, and what's really driving the growth. If you look at the growth today, it's all around these large unstructured objects. It's all around images. It's all around video. It's all around audio. It's all around that kind of data. That's what's driving it, and enterprises are going to latch onto that and start to build those kinds of services internally for their internal customers, for their users. The other thing that I think is going to drive this a lot is the whole analytics angle and the ability or the need for enterprises to now start to analyze the information that they're capturing or analyze the information that's out there and available for driving more competitive advantage, for driving new product introductions, for understanding market trends. For looking at where are new business opportunities that they could launch, all those kinds of things that are going to help enterprises become more competitive in their space. They're going to look at ways to capture information and then be able to analyze that information. And certainly the platform that they're going to be looking for is something that's flexible, something that's scalable, something that you can not only capture data and store data in, but you can also analyze data as you're doing that in real time and over time.
Can we talk a little bit about the breaking point? So an organization might be going along just fine, meeting their needs, growth rate, they can manage their growth rate. And then at some point, it's kind of like I'm all prepared for the 9-foot tidal wave, but then the 12-foot wave comes and I flooded half of Manhattan or something like that. What are the breaking points as it relates to storing large repositories of objects, unstructured objects?
Yeah, I think that's it's an interesting question. I think it's different for different industries. I think it's different for different organizations. But typically when you look at where customers are today, most of these large organizations are looking at petabytes, tens of petabytes, hundreds of petabytes perhaps, and in the case of the big companies we've talked about, even exabytes or tens of exabytes of information that they're storing and managing. So where's the breaking point? It's probably around a petabyte or a few petabytes in terms of what can you realistically store, manage, protect, make available, and do so in a cost-effective manner. I mean, you can get there. You can get there through brute force methods. You can get there through replication. You can get there through a backup or a backup infrastructure that protects information. But at some point in time, it gets to a point where if you're, let's say, making three replicas or three copies of your data, at some point in time, spending 3x the amount of storage to first house the data, then protect the data, then power and cool the storage, and then manage it, there's a financial breaking point in addition to a technical breaking point. And you know, when we engage with customers, it's generally around the you know the 1 or 2 petabyte range where that starts to get a little bit difficult. Certainly, if you get you know at a 10 petabyte range, it's starting to get very very difficult and very costly. And that's why I think customers are looking for alternatives to you know the traditional storage approaches that can deliver you know cost effective, reliable, secure storage options for their data.
So there's the aspect of replication, which is how a lot of people deal with availability, and then there's the issue of backup. Can backup and can replication be completely eliminated in these kinds of environments?
Well, I think at some point you have to look at, does it make economic sense to replicate data, you know, 3 times or 4 times in order to ensure that it's available? You know, it, certainly at tens of petabytes, that's a lot of storage that you're buying and powering and you know, cooling and managing. If it's online, if it's spinning, if you put it on tape, you know, you certainly address the, you know, some of the power issues, but maybe your data is not as readily available. You got to make that trade-off. I think there are levels, and I think it's probably in the 10 petabyte range that you can say, does it make sense to replicate to protect this data, or does it make sense to back it up? And even so, you know, what is my backup philosophy? Do I have to back everything up? Do I have to only back up the things that change? How often do I need to do backups? What are my objectives of backup? Is it to recover to a certain point in time, or is it just to ensure that the data is protected and available? And I think what you're starting to see is organizations at that level, certainly with unstructured data, are looking at different ways to store and manage that data, keep it online and keep it available in more of a you know an archiving type of use case or methodology that uses different you know approaches to protect the data and different approaches to make sure that the data is available.
David, lawyer on the phone, I think you had a question. Do you
want to go? Yeah, well, I had a comment, which is that the whole business model of hyperscale is very different. It's designing, putting in the minimum amount of equipment upfront and minimizing the amount of maintenance that's required, both by the vendors and by the installation. So you're trying to, if something fails, for example, in Facebook, they just turn it off. If enough servers or components fail, then they turn off the rack. And after 3 years, they replace it anyway, because it'll be lower cost to do that than to try and extend the life. And you know that model of looking at things on putting in much more cost up front is something obviously that large-scale enterprises, but in the shorter term, that cloud providers will have to embrace if they're going to compete with the likes of Amazon or Google or Microsoft for these types of services.
Sure.
So my question is to what extent are you providing your products in that open source, open multi-vendor type of environment that's being created?
So you kind of broke up there at the end. I'm not sure I understood your question, but I think there's a couple of comments relative to the topic that we're discussing. One, I think your point about the fact that, you know, hardware, commodity-oriented hardware, you know, at hyperscale is certainly something that people look at, you know, maybe not investing as much in the hardware, certainly investing in software capabilities that can deliver levels of reliability and availability of the data, but not necessarily have to have the significant investment in the hardware. And your point of, you know, if something fails at a certain rate or a certain level, you just replace it with, you know, with similar components or commodity components, and you know, the data is now readily available or replicated to that new componentry and it's now available. you know, that's certainly a viable approach at hyperscale, and I think you know most companies that are at that scale are now definitely looking at that. So that's a difference in terms of a backup or traditional approaches versus a hyperscale approach. But the key to that is you have to have a way of treating the data, a way of managing the data to ensure that it is reliable and ensure that it is available and ensure that if something fails, you know, the data can, the system can detect that there is a failure and it can recover from that failure. You know, when we talk about that with customers, we talk about the benefits of our dispersal mechanisms and erasure coding as a viable method at hyperscale to be able to ensure that the data is protected and the data is available should there be a hardware failure, should there be a component failure. And that's really what you're trying to guard against. You know, at hyperscale, that model certainly works. And as organizations, enterprises particularly, start to get to that level and start to get to that scale, they're going to want to look to those new models and, you know, the new commodity-oriented hardware models with a software layer or a set of software that can ensure that the data is reliable, the data is available, the data is protected, so they can spend less or invest less in the hardware or be able to replace the hardware if it fails very rapidly, and yet the data is still protected, the data is still available.
One of the things that we're seeing, Russ, is that there are these growing repositories of data. But then there are also these growing repositories of metadata, and when you combine the data and the metadata, you end up with different use cases with different performance requirements. And one of the things I'm interested with the approach that you use there at CleverSafe is, can the data dispersal approach, the erasure encoding approach, serve up the data at the rates that you need for all the use cases?
So that's a very good point, and as you're dealing with, you know, billions of objects or trillions of objects, metadata becomes very critical, and being able to identify pieces of information, being able to categorize that information, search it, find it, that kind of thing is very, very important. We offer, in our storage system, we offer the ability to store both object data and metadata. Using the same techniques, using the same dispersal techniques, so you get the benefits of reliability and availability of the data and the metadata in a similar fashion. And what that does is it allows essentially limitless scalability. You can scale the architecture, adding more and more storage nodes and more locations and bringing more things online very seamlessly and very easily and be able to take advantage of that infinite scale or limitless scale, both on the object data perspective and on the metadata perspective. Now, we deal with customers that, you know, that take different approaches. I'll give you an example like Shutterfly. Shutterfly does maintain separately a metadata database and all the metadata associated with those photos in a separate storage tier. And all the object data, the photo data and all the objects associated with the photos are maintained in you know, these large repositories. Multiple petabytes, tens of petabytes information captured in one large single repository. That's their approach, and they've been comfortable with that approach, and it gives them flexibility and reliability that they're looking for their customers. But there's multiple ways to go about keeping track of the metadata and keeping track of the data objects. But the key, obviously, is ensuring that metadata is available and it's usable such that you can use the actual objects. You can find them, you can retrieve them, you can recover them, you can update them as necessary, you can analyze them, which is a big piece of what's going on in our world today. It's the whole analytics piece. You know, being able to access that information quickly and easily through the use of metadata is very, very important.
Right. And can we just spend a little more time on the performance aspects? I mean, what kind of differences, we can use the Shutterfly example or a different commercial application as an example, but the performance requirements on the metadata, I would suspect, would be substantially different in terms of latencies that you'd expect.
Sure.
Right? Is that fair?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it certainly is, as I mentioned, in their case, a different tier of storage. It's a different, you know, database architecture that they're maintaining, you know, and access patterns and latency and all those kinds of things are architected in such a way that they can deliver the service at the time frames that they need to for their customers. So, and I think with most object storage systems, that's sort of the way that that people take advantage of it. They use object storage systems to store objects, and they may or may not use the object storage system to store the metadata. But if they need, like in the case of Shutterfly, rapid access, the ability to find or search or locate, an object in a pool of, let's say, 20 billion or 25 billion objects, they have a different architecture. They have a different structure in order to make that happen.
I don't know if you have visibility to this. Shutterfly just recently made an acquisition. I can't remember the name of the company. But it was in the context.
I think it's called This Life or something
along
those lines.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And This Life is in the content curation space, and so
right. So
it goes and reads through probably all the data that's sitting on your system then, assuming that that's the way that they're going to integrate the technologies, but reads through all the data that's on your system or on Facebook or other repositories, and then actually do a fair bit of the metadata creation. Does that change the workload on your side?
Potentially. I think the key that and value proposition that we're delivering is scalability and limitless scalability from an object storage perspective and being able to capture and store reliably and securely any number of objects, whatever size and whatever capacity they may be. As they start to integrate these other these other systems and objects or elements or data objects from other systems, and they start to bring them together to put together a lifespan or a duration of someone's life, it could potentially drive the need for them to certainly analyze and keep track of where things exist and where things reside, and potentially move those things into a CleverSafe or a larger object storage system like CleverSafe. But it's still kind of, I think, early in their thought process in terms of what they want to actually, how they want to actually utilize this asset and bring more and more of these capabilities to their customers.
Right. I want to pause for a second and see if there are any questions here in the community. We've got quite a number of people on the call.
Hi, this is Bob. I had a question. Earlier you were talking about the performance aspects of, say, metadata, and I know for certain stores like OceanStore, what they were, they actually advocate having cached copies of the whole object if you're looking to increase performance. Have you found or tried any of those, and what success or lack of success have you had trying to do that?
So Bob, I'm going to have to ask you to repeat or have John repeat because you broke up during your question.
So I think the question that you asked was, you're seeing people putting entire objects into the cache, is that right?
Well, let me restate it. So, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, all right, sorry. So, when you're using EC, the sort of attendant problem that comes with that is that the performance, the latency is increased, and I've seen that in two implementations.
Mm-hmm.
When I was at EMC. And so the question is, well, how do you increase performance then? And in some of the papers, such as for OceanStore, what they recommend is having local cache copies of objects as a way to decrease latency time. I was wondering if you had tried that in a real-world implementation and seen if that was worth it, not worth it, et cetera.
Yes, that is a method or a way to go after sort of the latency problem, and yes, there is additional overhead associated with erasure coding when it comes to putting all the pieces back together and delivering the final object. There's calculations that have to happen in order to put the information back together, which does increase the overhead. We CleverSafe have not delivered a solution along those lines, although we've done some prototyping and we think there are some ways to take advantage of a caching mechanism sitting in front of a large object store that can deliver the high performance or high throughput kind of results that certain use cases or certain models require. I'm not aware of any other erasure coding companies that have necessarily introduced products or techniques that can do that. Certainly, it is something that we are working with in the lab and playing with in our own development efforts. But it's not something that I'm aware of that exists as a commercially available product at this point.
I see. Thanks a lot.
This is Scott. I've got a question about basically down market. From everything you talked about, this is really an enterprise or a very large content-focused company or organization-type scenario. What kind of lessons learned are there for potential future SMB mid-marketplace or decisions that's made? Is there anything that's applicable to that space with regard to what's happening with hyperscale storage?
Did you hear that? Yeah, I got bits and pieces of that one as well, John. If you could repeat or ask somebody to repeat.
Yes, sir. The question really was, so we've talked about scaling up, but there's two dimensions. That is, I know Tom Lewis talked about scaling up and scaling down. Is there a dimension to your technology that says, okay, somebody who only has a petabyte should really go this way, or only has a couple of petabytes of storage should go this way? Does that make sense?
Well, so I think I understand the gist of the question, and really, where I think things are going with respect to the technology and approach is certainly people that are at a petabyte or tens of petabytes today understand the pain and understand the challenge that traditional approaches bring to bear. Others that are less than that, if they potentially could grow to that level, I mean, we're dealing with companies all the time that are, their full-on data capacity is in the tens of or hundreds of terabytes, but yet they're growing so rapidly that they'll be at a petabyte very quickly and be at two petabytes, very quickly beyond that. So they're certainly, looking to future-proof their storage infrastructure and look at ways that they can get to a capacity easily and grow with that capacity very easily. The other method that I think is starting to become popular is using storage services or storage as a service, or using service providers that provide storage as a service for organizations that are, say, less than that that capacity, that petabyte level of capacity. They can offer certainly a lot of capabilities, a lot of reliability and availability of data, but you're now giving your information to a third party, to a service provider, and expecting that they will protect it and that they'll ensure that it's available, those kinds of things. So there's trade-offs with that model as well, but I think a lot of organizations that are certainly below that capacity and want to use services that are out there can take advantage of all the different offerings that are there, and if they do continue to grow to a certain level, they may want to look at bringing it back in-house at some point in time.
Russ, do you have service providers who are leveraging your technology to deliver a cloud service?
So we are not a service provider. We do offer our technology to other service providers, and we do have some customers in the service provider space that are, housing the infrastructure and providing services to end clients and customers. We have both commercial customers in that space and federal integrators that provide that service to federal agencies as well. And I think that bodes well for the question that was being asked, and that is, are there different approaches versus just acquiring hardware or acquiring a system to gaining the benefit of dispersal and erasure coding from a reliability and a cost perspective? And certainly there are service providers that are out there that are looking at providing these kinds of approaches and capabilities for their customers. We're not going to be in that market. We're a technology company. We build systems. We build software capabilities, but there are certainly organizations out there that want to provide services for their clients and their customers and are looking at technologies like ours to do that.
So what do people think, this is Jay Blonde, what do people think happens to the enterprise hardware business as we know it? So you've got Intel's OEMs on the server side, HP, Dell, Cisco, certainly to a lesser extent IBM. I mean, IBM's got an x86 business, but and I guess Oracle as well is kind of a wild card. And then the storage side, add to those names EMC and NetApp, and I guess Hitachi, but certainly IBM and HP. So we talked earlier about hyperscale being a harbinger for the future of the data center. We talked about hyperscale being essentially commodity components on which you're running software services. So what happens to all Intel's OEMs and Seagate's OEMs? I mean, essentially, the server vendors have been marking up Intel microprocessors for years, and the storage vendors that sell into the enterprise have been marking up Seagate disk drives for years.
Right.
That dynamic seems to be, I guess we're predicting that's going to change in some way, shape, or form. What do people think about that? I don't know, Russ, if you have an opinion. Do the big server vendors have to figure out how to play in this market or get marginalized? How do they play?
No, I think they are starting to play in the market. I mean, you look at, what EMC is doing, first with the acquisition of Isilon and now with, some of the focus on Atmos. You look at what HP is doing. You look at all those major players out there, and I think they're starting to realize that the market is going in this direction, and they need to start making investments, and they need to start building capabilities in order to deliver those kinds of services to their customers. Now, I don't think that this approach or this kind of technique is necessarily applicable to all applications and to all uses of storage. I mean, there are certainly tier one type applications and tier one storage solutions that are not necessarily going to run very well on a dispersed system, nor necessarily going to be put on a commodity oriented storage device or server device. So their businesses in that respect will continue to be maintained, I would expect. However, if you look at the growth and you look at where the new data is coming from, and you look at all the fact that a lot of the different objects and images and types of data that people are capturing and want to use and collaborate with, et cetera, they do definitely have to evolve their offerings and be able to bring to the marketplace storage solutions that they can deliver at the price point, the scalability points, and the reliability and availability that we're talking about, so that they can compete, so they won't be marginalized.
So, but today their intellectual property is highly or intrinsically linked to the hardware, but oftentimes in custom ASICs, or certainly in software that they either bundle in or sell with their hardware. Do we see examples of these traditional companies that are in good positions to take advantage of this trend? What do people think?
Well, so I think that they realize that there are trends in the market and movements afoot in the market that are going to drive a lot more usage in this area, and so they are. They're partnering with other companies. They're partnering with the likes of disk drive providers and server providers and software providers such as us to deliver solutions that meet the requirements that we're talking about. I agree with you. I mean, I think a lot of the investments that they've made, up until this point, is in customized hardware and very customized software solutions, et cetera. But those won't, as we talked about earlier, those won't necessarily translate into this type of use case and this type of scale. So they're going to have to look at options and other ways to bring technologies to the marketplace that will address those needs. And certainly they're looking at either partnerships or, in some cases, acquisition to acquire a capability or a technology that will allow them to bring those kinds of solutions
So, John, we've heard some companies talking about, you know, abstracting or extracting the software and actually selling that separate from the hardware. Do you see the companies in a position to do that? I mean, you've been working with these companies for years. You were a customer of theirs. Are they in a position to do that, in your view?
You know, I think one of the things that's really difficult is the transition, and some of it's just the transition in the business model. Right. So if you're going from a business model where you're selling, you know, very high revenue, you know, high dollar amounts of hardware with a different margin model, but immediate revenue recognition to a software business model or a services business model, it's quite gut wrenching in terms of, you know, how the public market reacts to it. So, you know, I think the recent move, potential of Dell to go private as they go through a transition, what's going to probably be a pretty gut-wrenching transition at Dell, is maybe a harbinger of what some of the large enterprise companies need to do if they're going to successfully make that switch.
Wow, I mean, it's a complicated switch. Let me just say this, and then I'll let somebody jump in. I mean, let's say I'm selling a box today,
right,
for whether it's $1 million, $500,000, $300,000, $200,000.
Right.
All of a sudden, I'm going to sell this package, this software package, for a couple hundred thousand, 200,000, 300,000, 400,000, 500,000, a million.
Right.
I could see this is a serious customer backlash there. Well, wait a minute. What am I paying for? I that's a different mindset. Somebody else had a comment?
Yeah. This is David Fine. I would like to perhaps comment that the opportunity for vendors is not all lower cost. The model is that everything is going to be paid for up front of the hardware, and it'll actually, what they will want to do, or the business case for providing that hardware, is that you eliminate all the maintenance. So you don't provide that maintenance, and the customer doesn't have to provide that maintenance, and you have it there for a shorter period of time and then replace it. So there are some upsides to vendors who embrace this. There's continual replacement over a longer cycle, and the saving of operational costs will be huge, which will justify actually maybe slightly higher capital costs going in. So, in the case of Dell, of course, there is a specific reason why they will have a very significant reduction in revenue because of the reduction in the number of PCs being sold by them and other vendors.
Well, sure, and that's the PC sort of tablet shift going on. But how about Cisco? I mean, that's a classic case where you got a company that has a lot of, you know, some great with proprietary hardware and custom ASICs and the like, and now this trend called SDN comes in.
Right.
And now they're talking a good game. But what happens to Cisco? I mean, I wish Stu were on to answer this question. I'd love to hear his thoughts.
Yeah, the Cisco sell great boxes. They're integrated, and but they're much more expensive than they would be if the other model was taken. But however, if they embrace it and sell boxes which require no maintenance and which at the end of the day will, you know, be replaced in 3 years' time or 4 years' time, there's no reason why they couldn't be very successful in that model. It's going to need a great deal of courage to switch to it, as John was saying. But I think they can be successful and sell the software separately.
Right.
David, we did a quick switcheroo there.
There's two pieces. Of course, SDN is looking to kind of abstract the control plane. And then there's a discussion of the commoditization of the hardware itself because, you know, Cisco and everybody else is working on SDN. They're going to have, you know, open flow controllers. They're going to, you know, take that piece out of it. But if you look at what was discussed at the Open Compute discussion, it's the hyperscale guys, and what differentiates them is what you said, David, is I want the simplest components as possible. I want bare bones. I'm not going to buy them from somebody that puts together a solution that has, you know, 500 features I'm going to buy something that is, you know, very simple. It's based on a chipset. Things like the ODMs. If you looked at what Facebook announced with OCP, one of the suppliers they had, it was Intel, and it was Quanta Computer. Well, Quanta is the same company that's putting together just bare-bone switches built with, like, Broadcom chipsets. So a quarter of magnitude cheaper on what they can do, and if we can take the software and extract that out, I can still use a Cisco switch, or I can buy a switch that's much, much cheaper than that. And so that is the potential to truly disrupt, you know, Cisco and some of the other legacy guys who were all trying to pivot to really taking their software, bundling that, and making that the source of value.
Russ, is that consistent with what you're seeing from your customers?
I was just going to say, absolutely. I mean, the thing that we hear all the time is customers want, you know, at this scale, they certainly want to, they want a platform that you know, delivers a certain capability from a hardware perspective, but the real benefit or value that they're looking for from companies like ours is the guaranteed levels of availability and reliability that our software can provide. And, you know, they're going to very commodity-oriented, you know, componentry. A similar example that, you know, in the storage industry is using desktop-class hard drives versus, you know, cloud or enterprise-class hard drives, which are a lot cheaper. And if you can deliver the levels of reliability and availability using software sitting on top of that commodity-oriented hardware or that desktop-class-oriented hardware, that's the same or equivalent to an enterprise that, you know, twice as much, certainly you're going to want to go with the lower cost, especially at that scale. So absolutely the parallels are similar from a, you know, from what you were describing from a networking perspective and a storage perspective.
So is that how you go to market, Russ, is a software solution, or you offer both?
We're very flexible from a customer perspective. We offer commodity-oriented hardware platforms as appliances with our software on them. We also offer our software that we can integrate with whatever hardware platform that the customer wants to use, and we've done that on a number of occasions. We've worked with other OEMs, we've worked with other, you know, major and minor suppliers, as long as it meets a certain specification in terms of, you know, CPU and interface, network interface, and drive capacity. We can generally make it work with our software, and so we offer a very flexible approach.
So it's really software the way you want it, and the customer gets the pick, sort of, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So because we're certainly seeing, we've had a number of guests on recently who are delivering, you know, converged infrastructure that's got embedded software, it's got embedded custom ASICs or FPGAs or to accelerate certain parts of the workload. Thinking of some of the backup replication dedupe appliance
sure.
suppliers
sure.
That are out there.
Right.
A couple of them locally here. So,
as we talked earlier, I think there are certain applications and certain use cases that are going to demand or drive a specific or very proprietary oriented solution. But for this hyperscale, for the data that we're talking about, the video, the audio, the large unstructured object that's going to be written once, read, you know, quite a bit of times, like the use case that was discussed earlier, or something that's going to be more or less an active archive. It's data that's going to be saved, it's going to be available for essentially forever, you know, like somebody's photos at Shutterfly. The commodity-oriented hardware is a very good solution for that kind of approach. And with software like ours layered on top of it, you can deliver levels of reliability that are, you know, that you used to have to pay quite a premium for. You no longer have to do that.
I am intrigued, and maybe this is a follow-up for a later conversation, but I am intrigued by this notion of having created a large repository that was a, you know, store once, read occasionally, repository, but then you come along with some of this metadata creation, content curation solution, which all of a sudden goes through and reads the entire repository at once, right? So I wonder how they deal with that, and do they have to migrate that repository for the curation process, or it becomes a background task, or what? Do you know?
Well, so I can give you a real life example. It's not the this life example, but earlier or actually last year, Shutterfly acquired the assets from Kodak Gallery, Kodak Ophoto or Kodak
right.
Gallery.
Yeah.
And they did the very same thing, right? They migrated all of those assets from one repository to the Shutterfly repository, which is based on CleverSafe.
Like you, right?
Yeah, exactly. And as they were doing that migration, they obviously, tagged all those components and all those images with, you know, the metadata that was necessary for them to be able to offer those services now to, the Kodak customers. And that was a very straightforward, seamless process that, you know, their application was able to handle. And they did it all. I mean, I think they migrated about 12 petabytes, maybe 15 petabytes of data in about a month's time frame, and then actually once it was live and online, they actually moved part of it at a time from one location to another location. So once it came online, it was always available, but they were able to migrate the entire platform and the entire repository from one location to another by just keeping enough of it up and available and online if someone wanted to recall or use or take advantage of an image that was out there, it was still available. And those are kind of interesting use cases if you think about it, you know, that technologies like erasure coding or dispersal provide. You can actually pick up and move an entire storage system without ever taking it offline.
Without doing what?
Without ever taking it offline. It's always available.
And that's
the user
huge.
Can still get to the data.
Right. So I think that's a huge benefit when you start to think about these repositories, because you can't back them up anymore.
Right.
It's really difficult
right.
to replicate them, and it's nearly impossible to migrate them if you're on any kind of traditional architecture, right?
Correct. That's correct. I mean, it used to be that you put all that data on tape, and then you cover from tape in another location. It's too much data anymore to be able to do that in a reasonable period of time. So if you have to move it or if you want to, let's say, you know, a very valid use case for us is what we call start locally and then expand geographically. So customers start with a local repository in one location, and then as they want to start to take advantage of sort of high availability and site availability, they'll move parts of the system to another location and parts of the system to a third location. Never take that's a very valid case for us.
Help me again with the sweet spot for you guys with respect to response time. We've had end users on that are looking for 100 millisecond kind of response time. This last week I spent time who were looking for with some folks who were looking for microsecond response time because the difference between a couple of microseconds affects whether or not they get the trade or not. So. In your world, what's the kind of response time in terms of retrieving an object that you're looking to serve?
Well, to us, the most important thing is time to first byte, right? Because we're generally dealing with, a large object that's going to be streamed over, some period of time, and getting to that first byte and starting that retrieval process and whatnot is the most important. And obviously, as was discussed earlier, there is a bit of overhead associated with taking pieces of an object, putting them back together, recalculating, going through that calculation, and delivering it back out to the application or to the user. Processors today do that very, very fast. It used to be that was an onerous process, and CPUs were not fast enough to do that very well. That's not the case today. I mean, the latest processors from companies like Intel and AMD and others do that transaction or that calculation very, very fast. So for us, the key to delivering a response time that is adequate for the application is the speed of the network, how much bandwidth is available from the access point to the data storage repositories or the data stores we call them slice stores. They're actually the storage nodes that house pieces of data. So the speed of that network, the latency associated with that, the packet loss associated with that. So how clean is the network? There's not a whole lot of retries. If that's a very clean network, then it's reasonable to assume in a very valid use case that you can get you know, like you said, 100 millisecond, 200 millisecond response time, even geographically dispersed, as long as you have enough bandwidth and your packet loss is not that great.
Okay, that helps a lot. We had some folks on talking about the ad serving or ad bidding market recently, and
again, there are certain use cases where, you know, this kind of technology is not a good fit, but again, if time to first byte is your measurement, and then from there, it's streaming an object or recovering an entire object that maybe, say, a few megabytes in size, or even a few gigabytes, or even a few terabytes in size, you know, that process is generally pretty straightforward once you get to the first byte.
Yeah, no, I think the similarities in the two use cases, very different applications and very different technology, but the similarities in the use cases are that there's a whole bunch of stuff that you don't influence that impacts end-user experience, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But your part, you could do very cost-effectively and very quickly, given the direction with the technology.
Yep.
Yeah, okay, good.
Yep.
I think we got time maybe for one last round of question, or so. Anyone else to open up? Okay. Dave, any last questions from you?
No, I just, my comments and observations, I really do think that this discussion hits on the sea change that's coming, and I think that, you know, the hyperscale weaving into things that we've been talking around software-led infrastructure and obviously the data explosion are all kind of weaving together to really, you know, we've been talking about these. You could see it coming for years now, almost a decade, watching what Google and Amazon and Facebook have been doing, but now we're starting to actually see this bleed into the enterprise and commercial products, and I think it is going to have a ripple effect, and it's just fascinating times, and appreciate everybody coming to the call today.
Yeah, one of my takeaways from this is that there is it's absolutely necessary for the technology suppliers to be able to deliver technology the way the customer wants to consume it, whether it's a cloud service or it's a transaction I was involved in recently where the buyer basically jobs out everything from the disk drives to the processors to the servers and does their own system integration. So I think we're going to see a lot of different models go. But I think the erasure encoding data dispersal techniques fit a real need for a growing requirement within enterprises of all sizes. And the question is, when is it going to hit a broad market? But it's definitely coming. So thank you very much for joining us here today on the January 22nd Peer Insight. Russ Kennedy, from CleverSafe, thanks for joining us today. Thanks also. We had questions from Scott Lowe and David Sloyer.
And
Bob. Whoever you are, Bob. Thank
oh,
you.
Oh, yeah, Bob Primer.
Oh, Bob Primer. Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome.
Appreciate
thanks,
it.
Guys. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and we will be writing research notes over the next couple of days. Get them up on wikibon.org. Please feel free to jump in, contribute, edit, improve, enhance. And with that, I'm going to sign off now, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.